Today, what I'm going to talk to you about, though, is basically what I wish I had known about the intellectual life when I started. So if I could go back in a time machine to when I was 20 years old or 21, what is it that I wish I had known? And so basically what I want to talk about are really four things. The first is happiness. And then the next three things are all about balance. Balance between the intellectual life and the rest of life. Balance within the intellectual life. And then finally, balance between the life of a professional academic and the life of a public intellectual. So let me start off with happiness. Happiness, of course, is a huge topic, and we could easily spend a whole semester talking about what happiness is. But I'm going to use a very handy way of thinking about happiness that comes from Father Robert Spitzer. And he divides happiness into four different levels. Level one happiness is bodily pleasure, the kind of happiness you get from eating food or drinking alcohol. Level two happiness is various forms of winning and being better than others. So having more money, more popularity, more fame, things like that. Level three is all about serving others and helping others, doing good for them. And level four is about what he calls transcendent happiness. And that's about ultimately loving perfect beauty, perfect truth, perfect goodness, etc. Now, how does the intellectual life fit into here? Well, you could do the intellectual life for any of those four purposes. But it would not be a very efficient way of getting level one happiness. There's lots of ways of getting bodily pleasure that are easier and more effective than the intellectual life. But some people undertake the intellectual life for the sake of what Spitzer would call level two happiness, right? They want to be famous. They want to be wealthy. They want to be better than others in some respect. And I would suggest to you that the academic life, the intellectual life, isn't a very good means of getting any of those things. If you want to make a lot of money, don't go into the intellectual life. Are there a few intellectuals who make a lot of money? Yeah, a few, but you'd be much more likely to make lots of money going into finance, becoming a high-powered corporate attorney, becoming a plastic surgeon. There's all kinds of ways of making lots of money, or of being popular, or of being powerful, etc. But the good news is that those ways of being happy, as Aquinas points out in the Summa, are, in the end, really less than what you might think they would be. They're less than what you bargain for. So real happiness, according to Aquinas, according to the secular psychologists that do positive psychology, real happiness is all about love. It's about love of God and love of neighbor. And the intellectual life is a great way to have that, in part because the intellectual life is aimed ultimately at God. The intellectual life is about the truth, and God is the first truth, the source of all the created truths that we are able to understand and learn here. And then the idea is not only to know the truth, but to serve others by means of passing on the truths that you've learned. And in this talk, what I'm going to do is kind of pass on things that I've learned over the years that I wish I had known from the beginning about the intellectual life. And part of it has to do with virtue. So virtue, for Aristotle, is the golden mean, right? It's not too much, it's not too little. It's not too long, it's not too short. The idea of virtue, you might say, consists in a kind of balance. And so to have a successful intellectual life requires this kind of balance. So the first kind of balance I want to talk about is the balance between the intellectual life on the one hand and the rest of life on the other hand. So the intellectual life of its very nature is something that is a little bit like a gas. It will expand to whatever space you give it because there's always more books to read. There's always more things you could write. There's always classes you could prepare. Basically, it's unlimited. And so one way people can get out of balance is by not placing limits on the intellectual life. And so what would those limits be? Well, the way I've done it, which seems like a reasonable way to do it, is to think about it just like a regular job, right? So I normally work, say, 8:30 to 4:30, right? That's my kind of normal, typical hours. And I try to get all my work done within that time. Now, am I always successful? Well, no, I'm not always successful. But this way of working confines the intellectual life to a certain time span. And that makes room for community. And almost everyone expresses their love in community. So I'm a married guy, so I express my love in particular in my family. And people in religious life express that love in particular in their own religious community, their religious family. And this community, this love, if you have it, takes priority. So a famous example of this kind of community taking priority is from Bishop Fulton Sheen. He graduated from Louvain and earned a kind of super doctorate. So at the end of this, he received invitations to become a professor at Columbia University and at the University of Oxford. So he wrote to his bishop and said, well, which of these two wonderful positions should I accept? And the bishop said, neither one. Come on back, and I'm going to make you an assistant parish priest. And, you know, you're not going to pursue this intellectual life, so he thought. So he did. He came back, and he worked for a year or two as this lowly, you know, parish priest. And then the bishop said, well, now you can run on to Catholic U and become a professor there. But Bishop Sheen really made a priority of, at that time, Father Sheen, made a priority out of his commitments, right, to the church. In a similar way, William Lane Craig, a very famous philosopher, promised his wife that he would give up the academic life, the intellectual life, if it ever got in the way of his being a good husband. Peter Kreeft one time told me that the very best, most important books he ever wrote were the books he didn't write when his kids were young and he was raising his family. So he focused on that. So I'd encourage you, if you have those kinds of commitments of being part of a religious family or having your own biological family, to put those first. Those commitments matter. And so do your intellectual life. Do it the best you can, but make those other commitments to be primary. A second thing that's important to remember is what Thales said. So before Socrates, Thales talked about having a sound mind in a sound body. And so some people get the intellectual life out of balance because they neglect their physical health. They don't exercise 5 days a week. They don't eat right. They don't sleep right, etc. But you're not going to be able to sustain not just the intellectual life or any kind of life unless you take care of your health. And the last part of balance I want to talk about is, you might say, focus. So when it's time to work, I'd suggest that rather than multitasking, you monotask. The great Dominican priest Sertolange wrote a book called The Intellectual Life. And if you haven't read it, I'd really encourage you to read it. It's a wonderful book. And in that book, he said, let each task take a hold of you as if it were the only one. So the idea is, you know, focus just on whatever it is you're doing, right? Don't try to do three things at once or four things at once. Just focus it on one thing. Now, Sertolange was writing before they did studies of this. But as you probably know, multitasking is actually impossible. You really can't do that. What you really do when you're quote-unquote multitasking is you're switch-tasking. And the idea is you're switching between doing email and writing your paper and looking at social media. And every time you switch, basically there's a startup cost. Because when you switch from email to your paper, you have to reorient yourself. You have to say, okay, now where was I again? And what am I doing? And there's basically a great inefficiency that you introduce into your own life and a great waste of time that you introduce in your own life when you're switching from your email to your writing your paper to doing social media and back again. So when it's time to do academic work, pretend you're a laser beam. Get rid of everything else and focus like a laser beam right on whatever it is you're doing, the writing you're doing, the reading you're doing, whatever it is you're doing. So let me talk a little bit about balance within the intellectual life. So the intellectual life, I think, really involves three components. And for the Catholic intellectual, these three components are daily praying, daily writing, and daily reading. And I'd suggest that you try to do those things in that order. I remember when I was at Boston College how edified I was to see Peter Kreeft at Mass on Friday with another one of my great professors, Father Ron DeSalle, saying the Mass. And I thought, here's this great professor. He's written, I don't know, 30 books, and here he is praying. And then when I went to Notre Dame, I saw Ralph McInerney at Daily Mass also. You know, so busy doing all these great things, but he's making time for daily prayer. And this is absolutely essential. If you're going to be a Catholic intellectual, and not just an intellectual who happens to be Catholic in a kind of shallow way, prayer is essential. Now, how should you pray? Well, it seems to me, at least, that personal prayer is a little bit like exercise. So for you, maybe you like to exercise by running, and maybe you like to do jiu-jitsu, and maybe you like to swim. And that's fine. If you're really good at swimming and that's the best way for you to exercise, go for it. That's wonderful. For me, if I try to swim, I go to the bottom of the pool and it's over in like 5 minutes. Someone has to pull me out. So I don't swim at all. That's not for me. But find whatever works for you. So I think personal prayer can be a little bit like that, right? So you might be somebody who loves to do Lectio Divina, right? Read the Bible slowly and really get out as much meaning as you can. And maybe you're somebody who loves to do Eucharistic adoration, and you're somebody who loves to pray the rosary. Great. Find what really helps you to grow and develop and love God more. And they may be different things for different people. But make sure that it's a daily practice, right? And I'd schedule it right into your day. And I'd schedule it actually first thing in your day, so you make sure you get it done, right? Every morning, set the alarm right after breakfast or whenever. I'd suggest if you haven't been doing this for a while, start off with 15 minutes. Every day. This was a very helpful thing that Peter Kreeft, I learned when I was an undergraduate. I read his book called Prayer for Beginners. And that was one of his first suggestions, is every day, 15 minutes. And again, what you do is between you and God. And maybe you want to start your prayer by asking God, how do you want me to pray? And hopefully you'll receive some guidance on that. Second thing I would like to talk to you about is daily writing. When I went to Notre Dame, they had a presentation from academic researchers about scholarly productivity. You've probably noticed that some professors don't write any books, and don't write almost no articles. Some write a few, and then some write a whole lot. Well, what's the difference? What determines this? And basically what they did is they did a study, and they took one group of professors, and they said, we want you to write down a good idea whenever you have one. And then the second group of professors, they say, we want you to write down a good idea whenever you have one, and we want you to write Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for at least an hour. And then the last group, they said, we want you to write down a good idea whenever you have one, and we want you all to write Monday through Friday, 5 days a week, for at least an hour. And basically, the results came back from the study, and the first group of professors had the fewest number of self-reported good ideas. The second group of professors had more self-reported good ideas. And by far, the third group of professors had the most self-reported good ideas. The idea here is that writing generates new ideas, generates creativity. And so I would suggest to you that you spend some time every day writing. And by every day, I mean every working day, right? Monday through Friday, or maybe Saturday, take Sunday off. But, 5 days a week, 6 days a week. And your writing can be anything from the very first draft of something to the getting rid of typos in the thing right before it goes to the printer. And so sometimes you might sit down and write, I've done this many times, and literally type up, I don't know what I'm going to write today. I've got a paper due in, 2 months, and I literally have no clue what to write about. There was this one thing that maybe I could write about that, but that seems kind of shallow. Well, there's this other thing, maybe I could write about that, I'm not sure that's right. I mean, literally, just start writing like that. And basically what happens is, when you write every day, you'll have ideas. And oftentimes your ideas will come to you, not during the time you're writing, but later in the day. Right? You'll be doing dishes, you'll be taking a walk, you'll be doing whatever, and you'll think, oh yeah, I could write about that tomorrow. Right? So try to write every day. And this method really works. I know Peter Kreeft does it, and he's written over 95 books. And he writes the kind of books that he wants to read. Ralph McInerney, another mentor I talked to you about already too, he wrote 150 books, wrote or edited 150 books, and that's how he worked as well. So make time for it each day, and don't be intimidated. Just think about it like painting a wall. Like if I said to you, I want you guys to paint this wall this afternoon, you wouldn't be freaked out. You'd be like, okay, I'll paint a wall. Just get up there and paint a little bit, right? And writing is a little bit like that, right? A book is just nothing but a collection of one sentence after the other. So just sit down and start writing it up. By writing, I do not mean email. Email is an absolute killer for academic work because you write an email or you read it first and then you reply and then they write back and it goes back and forth. And before you know it, 4 hours are done and you've done no writing. So by writing, what I mean is things aimed at publication. Either at a scholarly journal or at a newspaper or whatever, but things aimed at some sort of dissemination. Now, when you write something, you'll come to a point where you think, is this ready to go? Should I send it out? And there was a professor at Notre Dame named Jean Porter, and she said her motto was, when in doubt, send it out. It's very easy to write something and then try to polish it forever. And you work on it, work on it, work on it. And you may think, well, I'm writing the next Summa Theologiae. Right? Scholars 700 years from now are going to be poring over every sentence that I wrote. And so I just got to work on it, work on it, work. Don't do that. Right? I hate to break it to you, but probably in 700 years, people are not going to be reading and poring over every sentence you write. Maybe they are, but probably not. Right? Most people, when they write things, they write it for the time and place they're writing, and that's the end of it. But when in doubt, send it out. If you send it out and it's accepted, well, that's good news. If you send it out and it's rejected, and maybe you get some comments back, well, that also is not quite as good a news, but that's useful information. So that helps you. So don't sit on things forever and try to perfect it, and et cetera. We really live in a target-rich environment for writing. So if you're ever having trouble figuring out what to write, what I would suggest is find something you totally disagree with and then try to refute it. This is a very easy way to write something when you're having trouble finding a topic. So there's an article that came out a couple years ago called Afterbirth Abortion, Should the Baby Live? And the authors of this article basically argued that, well, no, when a baby's born, alive, healthy, outside the mom, that if the mom or dad decide to choose to end the life of this newborn baby, then that's totally acceptable and fine. So as you can imagine, I was not totally persuaded by this. I really thought it was crazy. And I was able to write an article right away because I was like, oh, this is so wrong. And I responded right away. So that's a really easy way to write an article. Just find something you think is totally wrong and try to refute it, and you'll move right along like that. Now, one thing that happens in academic writing and other kinds of writing is that you might write up 8,000 words, say, and the journal or the venue or whatever says it has to be limited to 5,000 words, right? And so part of writing is cutting and getting rid of things you've written. And this can be very painful because what you write is first conceived in your mind, and then you give birth to it through your fingers. And so it's almost like you're little children, and to get rid of them is tough work. But I actually found a kind of workaround. Now, it does involve lying, but it's sort of a, I don't know, it's a lie to yourself. So here's what I do. I have a document, 8,000 words. It has to be 5,000. And I open up a new document, and I call it extra, whatever my original document was called. And then I tell myself a little lie. And I say, you're not really deleting all this stuff. You're saving this for a future project. And I cut out whatever needs to be cut out, and I put it in my extra document, and I pretend that I'm going to go back to it later and for my next project, you know, draw on it. In fact, I never do that, but I pretend that I'm going to, and it makes it very easy to get rid of excess stuff. Because I could, in fact, go back to it at some point and resurrect it and use it or whatever. But if you're having trouble cutting and reducing what you've written, just make a document called extra, whatever your original document was called, and just cut and paste it there. And it's there forever, and you can go back to it, you can use it. Okay. A final recommendation that I'll suggest for writing is that you start up a commonplace book. A commonplace book, these were used by thinkers like Marcus Aurelius, Leonardo da Vinci, John Locke, Thomas Jefferson, John Milton, Walt Whitman, Charles Darwin, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Benjamin Franklin, Beethoven, Ernest Hemingway, and in our own day, the filmmaker George Lucas and the Microsoft mogul Bill Gates. All of them have commonplace books. Now, what is this? It's basically a place, a book, where you write down interesting quotations, the wisdom of the wise, the follies of the foolish, insights that you have, weird things that happen to you, and just all kinds of things that you're not sure if you'll ever use, but that you could use. Now, in the old days, this was really challenging to do because they'd have to write all these things down, and they kind of characterize them, and they had to carry around big notebooks, and it just was a big hassle. Today, it's really easy. So all you can do is open up a Google Doc, call it your commonplace book, and you can stick all these quotations and aphorisms and ideas and facts and figures and all kinds of stuff in that. So in my commonplace book, I've got lots of interesting quotations, I think. So here's one. Augustine said, "I confess that I attempt to be one of those who write because they have made some progress, and who, by means of writing, make further progress." Another one from Aristotle, "Criticism is something we can avoid easily by saying nothing, doing nothing, and being nothing." Another quotation, not from Aristotle, but Oscar Wilde, "The pure and simple truth is rarely pure and never simple. I'm for the truth, no matter who tells it." It's Malcolm X. Here's a good one from Woody Allen. "Basically, my wife was immature. I'd be at home in my bath, and she'd come in and sink my boats." I kind of like that one. William Lane Craig, "Long ago, I realized that time is more valuable than money, for while you can always get money back, time, once it's gone, is lost forever." So the idea is, if you have all these ideas, quotations, aphorisms, and stuff, and you're giving a talk on time, right, you can just search the document for quotations about time, and you'll see a whole slew of ideas. The final thing I want to talk about is daily reading in terms of the balance of the intellectual life. So we have praying and writing and finally daily reading. The most important thing I'd say is to make time each day to read the most important of all texts that we have, and that would be from the Gospels. Make some time each day to read maybe the Gospel of the day, maybe slowly. Think of yourself as involved in the scene. I'd also make time each day to read from whoever it is that's your spiritual master. So what I do each day is I read an article from the Summa, and then I write a little bit, if the mood strikes, about whatever I read in Thomas. But you could read a little section each day from, I don't know, the sermons of Pope Benedict XVI, Pope Emeritus. That'd be a very easy and accessible way to get into things. So read a little bit from your spiritual master, whoever that is. And then I'd suggest to all of you, too, at some point in your life, to take a speed reading course. You can do this very easily online. You can get an app that does this. Now, there are some things that are very hard, if not impossible, to speed read. So, for instance, I find Aquinas impossible to speed read. I just couldn't do it. But there's lots of things that you're going to have to read that you can read really fast. And speed reading can really help you to get through material with haste. One quick way to do this is to use a pen or your finger and basically have your pen or finger underneath the sentence that you're reading. Because all of us do what's called retorsion, and that basically means you read this way and then you circle back and reread part of the sentence needlessly. Now again, sometimes if you're reading something really hard, you do need to reread it. But oftentimes you just kind of circle back and reread things without really needing to reread it. So what speed reading can do for you is help you to avoid that, help you to read chunks of text. So when you were just learning to read, you would just read one letter at a time, like the word bat. You read B-A-T, and then you try to put it together. Now, obviously, no one here reads each letter of the word bat. You see the whole word. And in fact, everyone here doesn't read just one word at a time. Everyone here, I'm quite sure, reads 3-4 words at a time, right? So you could read Johnny hit the ball. You could read that whole sentence in one chunk. So part of what speed reading is you read a bigger chunk than you normally would. So if normally your chunk of text would be 3 words, maybe you work up, now it's 5 words. So you're taking in the whole chunk of text more quickly. So this will save you hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of time if you take, again, on your phone or wherever, a kind of speed reading course. It'll allow you to work up to read bigger chunks of text more quickly. I'd also develop for yourself a kind of system of abbreviations for reading. So it's best when you read to make notations in the text if you can. And that's why it's best if you read to read with paper books that you own if you can, rather than read online. So by system of abbreviations, what I mean is, say, examples of mine would be, beside a sentence that I think is true, I write a T. Besides a sentence I think is false, I write an F. Besides a sentence I'm not sure about, I might put a question mark. If there's some great quotation, I put GQ. If there's some argument that really doesn't work logically, I put NS, non sequitur. But the idea is that if you mark up your text, then you'll be able to go back to it quickly and kind of figure out what you were thinking and interact with it in that sort of way. So that's very helpful. I would, and I follow Serge Lange in this, suggest avoid reading too much. So I have a friend who was working on a book on Habermas. And he said, well, Habermas was really influenced a lot by Heidegger. So he went back and started reading Heidegger. But Heidegger, of course, was really influenced by Scotus and by Nietzsche. So he went back and started reading that. Well, he ended up at the pre-Socratics, and he never wrote his book on Habermas, right? So read, but don't overread, right? And by overread, what I mean is, you know, going back and back and back, and you never get to writing. One thing that I found very helpful is to read something in the evening and then write about it in the morning, right? So this is really easy to do with journal articles. You read some journal article in the evening, especially when you disagree with, and then the next morning you can come back and write about the thing you just read about the night before. So that helps a lot. I would avoid what Serge Lange calls in his 1934 book, divertissement. I'll translate that as Twitter. Right? Don't get into excessive use of social media in terms of it's a huge time waste. So it's fine to use social media, but think of it maybe a little bit like salt on food. Like a little bit of salt on your food, great. But if you just open up the thing and you pour a pound of salt on your food, it's going to ruin everything. So social media, as you know, I'm sure, is designed to suck up your time. It's designed to be something that is very attractive to you, that you really, you know, it's going to hold your attention. So try to keep it confined. And I suggest basically like email, pushing off social media use until the late afternoon. And then, you know, as a break, maybe do it a little bit. I'd suggest finally reading the best, the brightest, the most fundamental, the most influential. So read whoever it is in your field who would fall under that category. And if you can, if the person's alive, I'd suggest when you write, sharing your work with that person. So you'd be surprised what happens. I sent an essay I wrote to Peter Singer, the famous, notorious professor at Princeton University. And it was a kind of pro-life thing, and it was critiquing Singer's view of personhood. And you know, I didn't know what would happen. I'm sure he gets lots of emails. But he wrote me back, and at the time I was visiting a scholar at Princeton, and he invited me to go to lunch with him. So I went to lunch with him. We had a big, long lunch, had a debate and conversation about it. I sent my work to another famous philosopher, Jeff McMahon, who's like Peter Singer, notoriously, you know, in favor of abortion and stuff. And he too invited me to coffee, and now we've gotten to know each other for a number of coffees over the years. The most famous book in favor of abortion is written by a guy named David Boonin. And David Boonin, when I wrote my book on abortion, not only read the book, but gave me about 24 single-spaced notes about the book. 24 pages of notes critiquing it, and he helped me very, very much. So when you write something critiquing, you know, famous Professor X, don't be afraid of sharing with famous Professor X, because sometimes, at least if the person can, the person will reply to you and give you critiques and say, no, you're wrong, you misunderstood my view. I also was able to do this in graduate school. So I wrote my dissertation on a moral theory that now is pretty much gone, but it was called proportionalism. And at the time, it was very, you know, prominent in moral theology. And I was able to study with Richard McCormick, who was basically one of the foremost proponents of proportionalism. So don't be afraid of going to the source of even views you disagree with to really understand them, because your critiques are going to be way stronger if you thoroughly understand the opposing view. And you really don't straw man it, but you steel man it. You make it very much something that they would recognize. And again, this was Aquinas' method. If you look at Aquinas' objections, very often he puts the objections to his own view in a powerful way that the opponents of his own view would recognize as plausible and their own. The final kind of balance I would like to talk about is a balance between a professional academic and a public intellectual. So a professional academic writes, say, scholarly papers aiming to talk to other peers in the field who have PhDs in their subject. By contrast, a public intellectual is writing for the common person. They're writing newspaper articles, they're writing journal articles that are read by all kinds of people. There's no footnotes, there's no Latin, there's no, you know, mathematical equations, etc. Now, if you can, I'd suggest trying to be both a professional academic and a public intellectual. Try to aim to talk to both audiences. You can get a virtuous circle where you write something for a professional audience And then you can rewrite it and represent it for a popular audience. Or you start off talking about some ideas for a popular audience and you recast it for a professional audience. So you can really benefit both audiences. If we think about the intellectual life as a life of service, right? You want to serve people, you want to help people. So you help your scholarly peers by writing academic things with footnotes with for journal articles that are peer-reviewed, and that helps them, hopefully, understand their field better. But it'd be great to be able to help also more common men and women, to give talks at parishes, to give talks to lay groups of various kinds, and write newspaper articles, etc., and help them. So try to, if you can, aim for both groups. Because again, if you think of the academic life as the intellectual life as one of service and love, right, trying to understand things and then trying to pass on what you've learned, then you'd ideally like to help as many people as possible. I would suggest, if you can, doing things like podcasts, things like YouTube videos, things like newspaper articles and blogs, right? Try to reach out to people that, you know, are maybe not in academia, not in the university. And doing interviews, though, can be a little bit risky because you can get people that have an agenda. They're trying to trip you up. And so I'm not saying always do interviews when people ask, but I'd say in general, try to do them, right? Try to reach out. Because if you don't do the interview, there's a very good chance they'll find somebody else to do the interview. And if they find somebody else to do the interview, it could be that this person is not friendly to the church, is not friendly to even belief in God. And so the view that's put out there may not be a great view. So you can do a great service by being available. But you do have to be careful. So I'll give an example from my own life of trying to be careful. This happened about 4 years ago. I got an email from a producer at Netflix. And the email said, do you want to be involved in a documentary about magic and free will? And I said, okay, yeah, that'd be fine. But why don't you talk to my friend Dan Speak? He's in my department. He works on free will. So I'm not really an expert in that area. But so they contacted him. He didn't want to do it. So they came back to me and said, we're really desperate. We want a Christian philosopher to talk about free will for this documentary. And I said, all right, well, I'll do it. So I show up at Marina Del Rey, and I was a little nervous because I thought, well, what is this documentary about? Are they going to try to debunk free will? So they handed me the papers to, permission to release my image and all that. And so I signed all the papers. And then I looked on, not the papers, but on the envelope the papers were in, and I saw at the top of the envelope, it was upside down, but I could read it upside down, and it said, free will is an illusion. And I thought, oh, Lord, they're setting me up, right? The idea is you've got the bumbling, stupid Christian philosopher, and then the savvy magician tricks him and shows him that there's no such thing as free will. So I thought, oh, what am I going to do? So I thought of just saying, well, forget it, I'm not going to do it. But I said a quick prayer to the Holy Spirit. I said, can something good come out of this? And I don't know, I felt like God was saying yes. So I said, all right, well, I signed the papers. I'm going to try it. So up walks Justin Willman. He has this Netflix series called Magic for Humans. And there he is. And he's this charming, intelligent guy. And so we have this conversation. We get on camera and he says, okay, so you believe in free will, right? I said, yes, that's right. He said, well, look, don't you think that we are material creatures, bodily creatures? And I said, yeah, I think we're bodily creatures. Well, he said, look at the rock and a plant and a dog. Well, they're bodily creatures, right? They're made out of molecules, aren't they? I said, yeah, they are. And he said, well, if we're made out of molecules also, right, how is it that you say the rock doesn't have free will, the plant doesn't have free will, and the dog doesn't have free will, but you do, right? Aren't you just made out of the same thing? I said, well, yeah, I think I'm made out of molecules, that's true. But you've probably noticed, Justin, that there's important differences, right, between a rock, a plant, a dog, and you and me. So for instance, one of the big differences is that you and I are intelligent, right? Rocks don't have debates about free will, right? Plants don't even raise the question. There's no dog that is going to discuss this, but we can. And because both of us are intelligent, we're able to think about things in ways that certainly plants obviously have no thoughts at all, and dogs and rocks don't. And we can think about the same thing in different ways. So think about, say, a very appetizing meal. Because of our intelligence, we can consider that meal in different ways. So you can consider the meal as tasty, as something that'll get rid of your hunger. But you can consider the same meal as fattening, and you're on a diet and you're trying to lose weight, so you don't want to eat the meal. Whereas if you put a tasty meal in front of a hungry dog, the dog is not going to debate and think about it in under different dimensions. The dog's just going to eat the food, whereas we can. So even though we are bodily creatures like dogs and plants and rocks, we differ from them in terms of intelligence, and it's because of our intelligence that we're able to have freedom. And he looked at me, and he seemed kind of surprised I had any answer for his challenge. But then he says, all right, fine. He gets out a deck of cards, and the cards are wrapped up. He says, here, take these cards out of the cellophane. I say, all right, take the cards out of the cellophane. And he goes, I want you to shuffle these cards as much as you can. You know, so I shuffle them up. I'm terrible at shuffling, but I kind of, you know, barely do it. And he goes, okay, choose any number you want between 1 and 52. And I said, okay, I'll choose 48. And he says, did you freely choose 48? I said, yeah, I freely choose 48. Okay, fine. Now choose any card you want. And I said, well, I'll choose the 8 of spades. Okay, well, did you freely choose the 8 of spades? Yeah, I freely choose the 8 of spades, yeah, okay. So he says, all right, he shuffles up the deck a little bit more, says, here, you shuffle my more, I shuffle my more. Okay, and he says, okay, I'm gonna start counting these out, and I want you to count along with me. So he turns over the first card, and I say, 1, it's not the 8 of spades. He keeps counting. He gets up to 30, 8 of spades has not arrived. And he said, so you think that you freely chose the number 48? Yeah, that's right. And you think you freely chose the 8 of spades? Yeah, that's right. But what if what you freely choose is just the result of random chance, like the shuffling of a deck of cards? And then whatever comes out, you call it free choice, but really just a random thing that comes out. I said, well, I don't know. I mean, you know, he says, okay, well, let's keep counting. So he keeps counting. He gets to card 47. He goes, all right, we've counted out 47 cards, and your card, the 8 of spades, has not shown up yet, right? You said you freely chose the 8 of spades. Is that right? Yes. And you said you freely chose the number 48. Is that right? Yes. But in fact, free will is an illusion. It's just the result of random chance. And then afterwards, we call whatever comes out free will. And he says, turn over the last card, the 48th card. And I said, I freely choose not to. He looked at me, I looked at him, and he said, aren't you curious? And I said, I'm very curious, but I freely choose not to. And he looks over at the director, and the director looks at him, I look at the director looks at me, and he goes, well, do you want me to turn over the card? And I said, if you freely choose to, why not? So he looked around, and eventually he just put away the cards, and the director said cut. And the crew ran over to me right after. He goes, that was great TV. Wow, that's, hey guys, we believe in free will, right? Yeah, we believe in free will. And Justin said, yeah, I do too. So there's been 3 seasons of Netflix that have of this show, Magic for Humans. So far, my episode hasn't aired. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what happened exactly. Anyway, balance in the intellectual life, a balance between the intellectual life and the rest of life, a balance within the intellectual life of praying, of writing, and of reading, and a balance of the professional academic and the public intellectual. And what is the point of all this balance? Well, the point of all this balance ultimately is love. That if we get out of balance, we're not going to be able to love God as we should, and we won't be able to love our neighbor as we should. And the ultimate point of that balance and love is to have that balance and love remain forever. To be in heaven with God, to be in heaven with those that we love and those that love us, and to enjoy God forever and ever. Thank you.